Hi, I'm Keith Gillespie. You're listening to the All Bets Are Off podcast.
As a word of warning, this podcast contains open and vivid discussion regarding gambling. Please err on the side of caution if you believe that this could potentially trigger a relapse.
Hello and welcome to the All Bets Are Off podcast. My name is Ryan and I'm your host. Before we get into it, I really wish to thank you for checking us out and giving us a listen. Obviously, if you are here and you're having difficulties with problem gambling, perhaps pre-recovery, or you feel that you're at risk or just at a really low ebb, then please, please feel free to reach out. Trust me, there are plenty of people on your side, including I, along with my co-hosts Chris, Kelly and Kish. There are also many support groups available, including GamCare and Gamblers Anonymous, among many, many others. We are all one big community, and so anyone who reaches out automatically becomes part of that family. There really is just so much support out there, so please don't suffer in silence. We're in it together. Keep the faith. Let's crack on with the pod.
Hello and welcome to the All Bets Are Off podcast, where myself, Chris and Kish have been joined by former Manchester United, Newcastle, Blackburn, Leicester and Sheffield United star Keith Gillespie, a man who also racked up 86 international caps for Northern Ireland. I'm sure many of our listeners will know all about Keith's story and his battles with gambling addiction, which was superbly yet heart-wrenchingly chronicled in his 2013 autobiography, How Not to Be a Football Millionaire. Keith, thank you for taking the time out to chat to us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant to have you on. Trust me when I say you're in good company here, and not just because of the addiction to gambling, but because Chris and I absolutely love our football. Kish, not so much, but you know, you can't win them all. Firstly, Keith, can we go back to the beginning? When did the gambling begin and why? And when were you first aware that this was becoming a bit of a problem for you?
The first that actually started was when I was at Man United. I was a young lad living in Diggs, and one of the other housemates, a couple of years older than me, a guy called Colin McKee, just said to me one afternoon that I fancy taking a walk to the bookies, and I'd never been in a bookies in my life. So I wandered up with him, and you know, I do think I've got that addictive personality, where as soon as I was in there, you know, it was just fascinating for me. From then on, it was a case of every spare time I had away from training or away from playing, I was in the bookies. And that's pretty much how it all sort of started. I think it takes a while in the future to realise how much of an addiction you actually have, because when you're sort of engrossed in that situation, you don't think you do. So I obviously suffered with it, with the gambling problems for many, many years after that then.
Thanks, Keith. Yes, Chris here. Wonderful to have you on and wonderful to hear from you. What you said there about being in that kind of bubble and not realising that you're in that addiction, I was exactly the same. I had no idea. You know, it took quite a long time for me to actually realise there was something going on here. But for me, great to have you on. You became a household name in the mid-90s, and this was an era in which many former footballers have spoken out about their drinking and, you know, the gambling culture that was out there. Could you describe to us just how prevalent it was?
Yeah, I think in a dressing room, you know, you've got so many different characters, and you know, you can have like bus journeys, and you know, there's boys will sleep, or there boys will watch a movie. There's some boys will play cards, you know, for money, and there's boys that'll be on the phone, you know, obviously when it was viable to do that and accessible to do that, where you could actually ring up and get bets on. Early 90s, obviously, you couldn't do that. You know, so you've got all different personalities in there. So, you know, I think every club you go to, there's always going to be three or four who maybe were involved in the gambling sort of side of things, but, you know, maybe not to the extent where I was. But, you know, I think it's just the way a sort of dressing room is, because there's so many different personalities. Everyone's going to be into something different. And, you know, I'd have played cards in the coach at once the online betting came in, you know, I'd have been on the phone betting on horses, and others would be as well. A few others on the coach. So that's pretty much how it sort of really spiraled out of control then, because when that online, where you could pick the phone up and get a bet on, that's where it really becomes a problem. Because before that, I think when you go into bookies, if you've got you know, X amount of money in your pocket. You lose that and you're out of there. Whereas now you're sort of ringing up and you're just giving numbers. You're not physically handing over that money. And that's where it can become a real, real problem.
Hi Keith, it's Kish here. And as Ryan mentioned, I'm not much of a football fan anymore. And I think the reason, the main reason being is I'm from Bolton, and you can imagine how they're doing. I can't even keep up where they're what league they're at the moment. So it's not been too enjoyable in the previous, say 10 years of watching football.
No.
So I guess my question is related to how gambling is often seen as a silent addiction, but you described that you knew about several people in a club, or a few people in a club, and how did that come about? How did you learn about other people's gambling?
Yeah, I think when you spend so much time at a club and with people in a dressing room, you get to know them and what they like. And, you know, it could be a case of you're sitting in a dressing room and there's newspapers about and you see people reading the racing pages, so you know they're obviously interested in that. And then, you know, I'd be one to be doing that. And then, you know, other people, you know, would maybe be interested in it too. And then they'd be going, oh, I've got a tip for this, I've got a tip for that. And then before you know it, it's around the whole dressing room. And, you know, some people take it in, some people just obviously aren't interested in that sort of thing. So I think that's how a dressing room works, really. You sort of just know each other. You know, you're training every day with these people. You're going away on trips with these people, you know, for away games, hotels and stuff. So you're with these people a lot of the time. So everybody knows who likes what, you know, and especially even on the coach, as I say, when you're sitting playing cards, you know straight away when you get on the coach who's going to be playing cards, who's going to be watching TV, who's going to be sleeping, you know. And I mean, that's just the dynamics of a dressing room. You know, that everyone has different sort of interests. So you just get to know pretty much people inside out then.
Yeah, thanks for that, Keith. And actually, what I find interesting about that is maybe these days that's slightly different. Obviously, there are still footballers out there and other professional sportsmen who are going to have issues with gambling. And like you've touched on, you've got the online side of things now, so people can do it on their phones and very secretively. But I imagine when you're talking about, you know, it was just right out there in the open. And as well as players, you know, with their managers being involved, you know, was it seen like it was an okay thing to do on the bus? I imagine it was. I'm thinking of certain football managers who, you know, I can think of from that time, and, you know, they still advertise gambling right now, so I imagine it was just the norm. And I imagine that might have changed somewhat, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think back then it wasn't really, you know, a taboo topic. You know, it's very much in the public now. And, you know, even when I was at Man United and I started going to the bookies, and everyone sort of knew I'd be there every day, you know, because, you know, you're seen there. And, you know, you're at Man United, so, you know, the likes of Alex Ferguson knows everything about the club and what you're up to. And, you know, I remember I used to bring on the fixed odds coupons, and I used to, you know, when you're leaving the bookies and you take them home with you and have a look at them and study them. And I used to bring them into the training ground. And before you knew it, you had the physios had a wee syndicate, and then the coaches had a syndicate. And occasionally Alex Ferguson would call me into the office, you know, again, because there was no online betting, and the only way of physically getting on a bet was to go into the bookie. So, you know, on a Friday afternoon, I used to go up to the manager's office, the physios and the coaches, and they used to give me the money, and I used to go down and put the bet on. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, footballers obviously aren't allowed to bet, you know, on football, which, you know, is a little bit crazy in terms of, you know, I think a footballer, you know, if he was to bet on a game in the Chilean second division, you know, he would be pulled up on that, you know, which is quite crazy. I understand that, you know, you shouldn't be betting on the leagues you're playing in or games you played in. But, you know, I even did that as well, where I bet on a game that I was playing in, obviously for us to win. But, you know, I think it's just more out there in the open now. And the one thing about it is, I think every time you know, with football, you know, and there's a half time, the first advertisement you see is an advertisement for next goal score in the second half or a correct score line. And it's, you know, it straight away people, you know, reach for the phones and you know, it draws them in. So I think, yeah, in terms of what I was saying, it is more of a topic that people are sort of talking about now, whereas back in the sort of, you know, early mid-90s, late 90s even, it wasn't that sort of, you know, topic where people were talking about as much.
And Keith, in terms of obviously footballers, as we all know, at the very top level earn an awful lot of money, and there's a lot of disposable income there. Is it a case of having all of that money, you always feel that, and it sort of buys into that sort of gambling sort of sense where, you know, you've always got something coming back, and, you know, does it feed your addiction even more?
I think without a doubt. You know, I think a lot of, in the early days for me, there was a lot of boredom, you know, when I was at Man United, because, you know, you trained and you went home to your digs, and, you know, you're on a YTS scheme at the time, you're earning £46.75 a week, and there's nothing really to do then. And, you know, you're down in the bookies and, you know, you're putting £1 on, £2 on, but just to fill in days at times, you know, with the boredom. And I think it sort of, you know, spiraled a little bit more out of control when I got the move to Newcastle, because the first 5-6 months of my life, I was living in a hotel in a city that I didn't know. And it was a case of you trained 10:30 every day. You maybe had a Wednesday off, but you went to training for an hour and a half, and then the rest of the day is your own. And, you know, I'm 19 years of age, and the rest of my teammates are married with kids and families to go home to, where, you know, I'm going home to an empty hotel room. And my afternoons then were in a Ladbrokes in Gosforth in Newcastle, and that filled in my days. And but it obviously with money, in terms of when your wages increase and so forth, and we all know, you know, today the money in football, but, you know, in terms of being relevant, you know, it was obviously good money back in the 90s as well. So, you know, when you lose, you're not that, you obviously you don't want to lose, but you know you've got a hefty pay packet coming, you know, and you can start all over again. So that is a problem, because, and especially in today's society with the money that the players earn, you know, it's absolutely crazy. And I'm sure, you know, players who maybe lose 30, 40 grand one day, that's just a drop in the ocean to them. And the problem is for sort of your normal man on the street who has that addiction, but it's just, you know, getting into more and more debt. Whereas with footballers, you know, it's probably not the case, because of the huge amounts of money that they do earn.
And you talk about modern day footballers now. Nowadays, football is a lot different to when you were playing, and there's a lot of focus around mental health and the fact that it's okay to not be okay. And in the current era, football players have, you know, player liaison officers, and there is, of course, the PFA. Was reaching out for help ever something that you considered doing, or was it seen as being weak back then?
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, the worst day that I had was back in 1995, and I lost 47 grand in one day. And you don't want to reach out for help, because you're embarrassed by that. You know, it's an embarrassing sum of money, £47,000. And, you know, I back then, I still never thought I had a problem, you know, and you just always think that with betting on horses, especially, you're always chasing that next winner. And, you know, I remember even being in the bookies in the early days, and, you know, there's maybe races gone off simultaneously. And you could have four different, you know, betting slips in your pocket, but you're already looking at the even further ahead of that, and right before the four that you've got have even ran. And, you know, it is tough in terms of, you know, being so young at the time, not having sort of the people around you. You know, it's a very different scenario to most, where you're sort of earning this big money, but, you know, there is that problem where, you know, you don't have your family with you. I'm from Northern Ireland, obviously. I'm living in England, you know, and you just don't want to reach out for that help. But as I said before, I didn't feel that I needed it. I probably should have. That probably should have been the wake-up call that I needed back then. You know, I'm 20 years of age at the time. But, you know, again, you're sort of just thinking, well, I've lost 47 grand, but I've got a good wage coming every week. You know, I can deal with that. But you obviously don't look long-term in terms of, you know, you can't continually keep losing this sort of money. So that was a real problem.
Thanks for that, Keith. I thought it was really interesting to hear how you lost such a large amount at such a young age, £47,000 at 20 years of age. That seems sort of impossible for a lot of people. Obviously, with your background, it makes a lot more sense. But what I wanted to get to was sort of, you were doing this in a betting shop, and did anyone else sort of raise a finger? You're obviously writing down a figure onto betting slips throughout a day. And there are staff there. Did anyone at the betting shop ever raise this up with you and say, "Are you okay?"
No. To be fair, when I lost the 47,000, that was obviously 1995. But I just previous, maybe a month previous to that, 3 weeks maybe, was able to start betting online with a bookmaker. So that was all. That wasn't even done with a credit card. You know, the guy pretty much knew I was a Newcastle United footballer. So, you know, it wasn't like you do credit checks or anything like that there. He knew I was earning good money and what have you. So I was just basically ringing up and putting bets on all afternoon. And, you know, it's crazy because I remember that day, you know, it was 27th of October, 1995. And I remember that day especially because my first daughter was actually born on the 27th of October, 12 years later. So it's crazy how the scenario is there. But yeah, I remember the first bet I had that day, and I had £1,000 on a horse called Quandary. And it won at 6-5, you know, so you're sort of 1,200 quid up, 1,100 quid up straight away, 1,200 quid, whatever it is. And then you start sort of getting bigger and bigger with your bets because you wanna win big. But 4 hours later, I'm sitting and I've lost 47,000. And it wasn't one of them where I kept the note of what I'd bet on. You know, how much I'd lost in this, how much I'd lost in that. It was a case of once the racing had finished, then I rang up and I had to ask, you know, what sort of money I owed. And when they said 47,000, you know, I was absolutely gobsmacked. And, you know, there was winners throughout that day. But, you know, when you talk a deficit of 47,000, you know, the chances are I could have actually bet 75,000-80,000 pounds that day, you know, because there was winners in there, you know. So to be able to do that in the space of 4 hours is, you know, looking back is, you know, it's mind-boggling, really.
Yeah, and yeah, thanks for sharing that. And it is really mind-boggling, really, because you know, one of the main things that is characteristic of an addiction with gambling is betting with increasing amounts, as you said, and chasing that dopamine, the adrenaline, as you described. And it seems so obvious when you describe it, but it seems also like no one actually called you, or no one tried to speak to you about it. And in fact, you actually had to call and ask, and you know, ask what the situation was. And I imagine that would have been difficult to not only do, but also to sort of hear it over the phone. I'm wondering if you want to talk a bit more about how that made you feel.
Yeah, you know, I was playing on a Newcastle side that season who were exceptional. We'd started the season really well, and I was playing the best football of my career, which was you know, crazy. And I remember, you know, I lost that 47,000 on it was a Friday afternoon. We weren't playing to the Sunday, we were playing Tottenham in London, and we trained Saturday morning, and then we travelled down on the coach, and you know, quite long journeys, obviously, from the northeast down to London. But in the process of travelling down to London, I lost another 15 grand that afternoon, so it was sort of £62,000. So, you know, again, you're sort of 20, you're very naive, you know, you're thinking, oh, I've just lost 47,000, you know, but you always think, right, I'll try and chase this and try and get it back. And then you get further and further into it. And I remember actually playing the following day, and bear in mind, I'd sort of just lost the 62 grand, and I went out on the Sunday, and I had a really good game. And as I say, I was having a good season. I remember coming back on the coach, and I was sat at the back of the coach, and Peter Beardsley was sat beside me. And you know, Kevin Keegan was great. He used to, you know, if results were favourable, you know, bring a few beers onto the coach or a few glasses of wine or whatever. So, you know, we were sitting with a beer and that, and Kevin Keegan would sit at the front, but he came down to the back of the bus. And I remember him sitting at the table opposite me, and he pointed at me, and he says he could just be the best player in the country at this time. And Peter Beardsley sort of looked and says, I wouldn't disagree. And I'm sort of, you know, it's a huge thing for him to say that, you know, it's something I'll never ever forget. But I'm sort of just like thinking in my head, gosh, if only he knew the last sort of couple of days I've just had, you know. But because one thing people always say to me, did I think that gambling affected my football? And I would say no, because for me, when I was away from football, gambling was all I did. But when I was training, when I was playing, that was a release away from the gambling side of things. So I don't think it you know, affected my football. But some people might sort of disagree in terms of the way I performed at times, but I didn't think it did.
No, I totally get that, Keith, actually. I really, really do. You know, like in the type of job I do, you know, I'm not a footballer. A bit too big for that nowadays and a bit too old. But you know, I, you know, one day I lost my wages at the time were about £49,000 for a year, and I lost that over three gambling sessions in 3 days. And the last day, you know, I managed to put £22,000 of a £25,000 loan into an online casino in 2 hours and 11 minutes. It was absolutely crazy. But you know what? If I was to go to work the next day, nobody would know. Nobody would know, because you have to just be you. It's that hidden.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
The hidden addiction, and people just don't know. So I can totally get when you're saying what Kevin Keegan was saying to you there. People just don't know. You're holding this all in yourself, and that's where this kind of mental health problem comes with gambling addiction as well, because we're just holding it all within. There's no outlet, I think. And certainly from my side, I started gambling to cover emotions because I couldn't talk and I didn't have an outlet. So gambling became one of those outlets. I was also an alcoholic and I drank before, and then after the drinking I became a gambler, and that was my way to try and avoid the issues I had in life. But you know what? People could see I had a drinking problem. They could not see that I had a gambling problem. So I think that's really interesting what you're saying. I just wanted to pick up on one other little thing you said earlier on about when you're in bookies and you might have had 4 betting slips, but you were still looking towards the next race. And I think that just perfectly shows what like a compulsive gambler or a problem gambler is. It's someone who can't enjoy that moment that they're in. You know, I think a normal gambler, somebody like one of my brothers, for example, I don't know if they gamble or not, but they're certainly not compulsive gamblers. I imagine they would put a few quid on a horse and they would watch that horse. And if it won, amazing. If it didn't, fair enough. And then they would leave. Or if they did put some money on another race, they wouldn't have been worrying about that race while they were watching the other one. And I really love that, because I think that really, really demonstrates how our minds work. So thanks for sharing. Just one other thing I wanted to jump into now was, obviously you said you played the best football of your career at Newcastle and that kind of stuff. And, you know, you did. You were a fantastic player. That's when I was, you know, I was my early teens at that stage. So, you know, I loved watching that Newcastle side, even though I'm a Liverpool supporter. So I'm very happy at the moment.
I am sure.
But it's like in times of injury and stuff like that, I just wondered, did you then turn to the gambling? Because obviously you had the football to turn to the rest of the time. But when there was injuries or maybe you weren't getting selected, that kind of stuff, did you turn to the gambling or did that not happen?
No, with injuries and that, I mean, it didn't matter for me. You know, gambling was just always going to be there. You know, you can get a little bit down when you're not playing, when you're not selected, which is tough. But, you know, it doesn't change your mood or your sort of desire to gamble. You're always gonna want to do that. You know, I was quite fortunate where I never suffered too many injuries over the years. But, you know, whatever mood I was in or at the dressing room or you know, around the training ground, you know, you're sort of thinking as soon as training's finished. You know, I said before that my release was training and playing, but as soon as you walked off that training pitch, you were thinking, right, get in the shower, changed, home, and then on the phone all afternoon betting. You know, when that obviously became available, but before that it was like changed, wouldn't even drive. When I first went there, I wouldn't even drive back to the hotel. I would drive straight to the bookies, and that would be me all afternoon. And it'd be even worse in the sort of summer months or whatever, because you know, you're in there maybe from 1 o'clock, you're leaving after the last race at 9 o'clock at night, 9:15. So you're in there solid all day, you're not eating properly, which is another thing. You're going to the shop next door and buying crisps and sweets and what have you. You know, it's not like you're sitting down to a meal. So that was just the way it was for me, and it was a case of I just couldn't wait to get to the bookies. And you know, even the night before, you'd be looking up what the racing was tomorrow and the runners and what have you. And then, you know, you meet people in the bookies as well, and they give you tips and you get to know the people, you know, the regulars in the bookies, you know, you become one of the regulars yourself. And, you know, it's sort of crazy, you know, thinking back that, you know, I'd get up in the morning at 9 o'clock, I'd be in the training ground for 10 o'clock, finished for half 12 and in the bookies for one and in there till 9 o'clock. And that was your day, every day. You know, and you have a day off and you're in there early in the morning from maybe 11 o'clock and you're betting on the dogs early at 11 o'clock. And, you know, it just became more of a routine to do that for me.
So, Keith, you talk about, meeting regulars in the betting shops. And I recall from your book, I think, if I recall correctly, it was a few years ago, you had an affinity to one gentleman who would often give you tips on games that you're involved in particular. I think he knew that you obviously played for Newcastle. And what was that like in terms of, would you follow his lead? It was mainly to do with, you know, goal scorers and predicting the scores of games, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the guy in question used to be in there because he owned a shop sort of a few doors up from the bookie, so he would be in there quite regularly. And, you know, he wasn't sort of like a small punter. You know, when you look back and you're sort of throwing £100-£200 on, you're thinking, well, you know, he's obviously well into it, and he would give us the odd tip or whatever. Where he got them from, I don't know. But as I mentioned before, the 95-96 season, when Newcastle, we started the season so well, and it got to like October time, and I remember him saying to me one day, you know, because he would bet on the football, and it wouldn't have come into my head to bet on a game that I was playing on, but this particular day, it said to me, 2-0, 2-1, 3-0 and 3-1 were our most common scores that season. So I'd gone down to a cup game at Stoke. We normally travel down the night before a game, but I'm not sure of the reason for this, but we travel down on the day of the game on this particular occasion, and you go to a hotel, you have a pre-match, and then you sleep in the afternoon. But I'd maybe only had the phone account then for maybe 1 to 2 weeks, maybe three tops. And I was betting all afternoon. And one bet that I used to actually do a lot of times every day would be pick four horses out and do £400 trebles and £100 accumulator. And I remember this particular time where I'd had the £400 trebles and £100 accumulator. And the first three had come in, and I remember the fourth horse. And again, I'm actually listening to, and I'm actually ringing up, putting the bets on. I didn't have a mobile phone. I'm ringing, you know, when I used to put bets on from the hotel, I used to use the phone in the hotel. And I remember my actual bill for that afternoon, because I was listening to the commentary races, was £198 for the afternoon. Which was crazy. But as I say, the £400 trebles, £100 accumulator, first three won. The fourth one, I listened to the race, and it was a photo finish, and straight away you're on the teletext and you're on BBC One, and sometimes you would, you know, if it said photo between 1 and 4, you'd be like thinking, oh, one's got it. But then you went to Channel 4 and it said photo between 4 and 1, and you're thinking, oh. And the photo finish lasted about 10 minutes, and I'm thinking, well, chances are it's a dead heat, but lo and behold, the result come up, and mine was second. So it was, and you know, it was. I didn't work out what I would have won, but it was obviously quite a few quid. But I still won £3,500 off the bet. And I was about to leave the hotel, and it just came into my head about the score lines that the guy had told me about. And Peter Beardsley hadn't scored in about 6 games, and I thought, right, I'm going to ring up and bag Peter Beardsley for first goal. And I had a £500 single on Peter Beardsley at 6-1. And then I had £500 doubles on Beardsley first goal, 2-0, 2-1, 3-0 and 3-1, all £500 doubles. So about 40 minutes gone, Peter Beardsley scored the first goal. So everything's looking good. Just before half time, he scored the second. So everything's looking even better. About 15 minutes in the second half, I had a cross shot. The keeper palmed it out, Les Ferdinand, had a tap in, so it's 3-0. But my problem then is there's half an hour left. So I'm not really wanting to, you know, being a forward-thinking player, every time I'm getting the ball, I'm thinking, I'm not really wanting to put this into the box here, or pretty much playing sidewards and backwards and what have you. shanking it into the crowd at times, probably. But I even remember Paul Pescasolito played for Stoke at the time, went clean through and goal about 10, 12 minutes to go. And I was sort of right behind it, and he tried to lob it over the keeper. And I was like sort of thinking, you know, go in, you know, because 3-1 was obviously better for me than 3-0. But he put it wide. And then 6 minutes to go, Darren Peacock ventured forward, and you know, Darren was a really good defender, but never scored too many goals. And all of a sudden, it felt him in the box, and he rifled it into the top corner. And you know, because it was such a novelty for Darren to score, everyone was running and jumping on top of him. And apart from me, I was sort of trudging back to the halfway line, thinking, you know, he's just cost me $52,000. You know, and that happened on the Wednesday, and then on the Friday was when I lost the $47,000 in the one afternoon. So you know, the difference, you know, could have been, you know, so much where I'd obviously got this bet up on the Wednesday. There's no doubt I would have had a day like I did 2 days later, no matter what. But in the space of sort of 2 days, to go from very close to winning, you know, $52,000 to losing $47,000, you know, you're talking $100,000 turnaround there. You know, so that was the only time. I've backed myself to score the first goal before. I remember one of the guys, I think he owed me 30 quid at the ground. He was going to give me it, and I said, I'll just throw it on me to score the first goal, and I actually scored the first goal that night. So I did, and it's not something that would have happened too often. But I think you know, there's a problem obviously if you're going the other way and you're backing your team to lose. You know, back then, you didn't see it as a problem where you're backing the team to win. But I can see nowadays, you know, if you're playing the game, you've backed somebody to score the first goal, you've got a chance to score, and you try and pass it to them to put it in the net because of gambling reasons. You know, so that's obviously not a good thing. But I think that's probably the only time where I backed a game that I was playing in where I backed to, you know, to try and get the correct score, because I never ever done it again after that. Even though he had said to me 2-0, 2-1, 3-0, 3-1, I never did it again, which is quite strange that I didn't. And I'd probably love to actually look at the fixtures sort of after that to sort of see, you know, how the games for the rest of the season, how many actually finished with those scores, 2-0, 3-0, 3-1, 2-1. You know, so it's something I must actually look up and see whether I would have won a bet or lost a bit more.
Thanks for that, Keith. Time now for a quick break. Upon our return, we'll be looking into a little bit more in terms of present day and Keith's thoughts on the monopoly that gambling appears to have over football, especially regarding the sponsorship side of things. We'll be back in a moment. So here we are on a quick break. This is the part of the show in which I ask our listeners to go give us a follow over on Twitter. Our handle is @allbetsareoff_. You can also go and check out our website, www.allbetsareoff.co.uk, which has much more information about the pod and the team behind it. Along with that, there are also some useful links to various charities and support services in this particular sector. It's now time for part two.
Welcome back to part two of the All Bets Are Off podcast, in which we're still here with the man renowned for doing this.
Oh, it could call! Marvellous goal by Keith Gillespie! 4 minutes gone, second cap tonight for Keith Gillespie, the 19-year-old from Manchester United, and what a start for Northern Ireland!
Keith Gillespie, it's very much Gillespie! Brilliant for Blackburn Rovers.
We would now like to get your thoughts on the present day. Do you think that football is being oversaturated with gambling companies? We're talking everything from sponsorships, front of shirts and hoardings around the stadium, through to the television advertising, and overall the matchday experience. For reference for everyone, it's 17 of the top 20 sides in the Premier League that have a partnership with a gambling company. 10 Premier League sides that have a betting company's logo through sponsorship on their shirt. And I believe it's even worse for the Championship League.
Yeah, you know, you've just given the sort of numbers there, so you can see straight away that, you know, it is obviously too much. And I mean, you can look at clubs and obviously it's a business as well. And, you know, if they're going to get offered money to have their name on their shirt or whatever, you know, be sponsored by them, you know, you can understand that. But I think the clubs too, you know, should have thoughts in terms of the well-being of their players, you know, especially because gambling is such a big thing, and it is an illness at the end of the day. You know, so there's plenty of players, obviously, in the Premiership who, you know, we probably don't even know about who have that problem, the gambling addiction, you know, and as I say, there's going to be so many. And, you know, they're running about on a Saturday afternoon with this logo on their shirt, and they're like, you know, heavily into that. And I mean, it's such a big business, football now. You know, and I do get where they do have to make money, but I don't know how that will ever change if gambling companies are prepared to pay so much money. You know, it's such a big industry, the gambling industry. You know, I'm not sure of the figures or whatever it is, but I'm sure it's billions a year. You know, so it's a tough one, but it certainly is. It is overcrowded in terms of the amount of teams that are obviously linked to betting companies.
Yeah, thanks for that, Keith. I think that's I love what you were talking about there, and I do think is there's too much of it in the game, and it's great that you're talking about the players as well, because very often, you know, we talk about children, we talk about us compulsive gamblers outside of football, but obviously there are footballers who are going to be this as well. And, you know, I wouldn't want to walk around with a with Betway on my top, you know, West Ham and my local team, and that's what they've got on their show. I wouldn't want to do that. But what I just wanted to throw in there was the children at the moment seeing this. I know they don't put it on children's shirts anymore, but they see the players of it on. And the other day I was thinking about what do I remember of football shirts when I was a kid, and just some things that came to mind, you know, Crown Paints, Candy, BAC Windows, West Ham, Dagenham Motors, Dr. Martins, let me think, Newcastle 95, Nuki Brown maybe,
yeah,
was it?
Yeah.
What did I? Yeah. So I'm an alcoholic as well, so I should remember that one. But do you know what I mean? I don't remember any gambling companies at that time, and I think that's my worry now. So I don't know. I just really want to get a little bit of your thoughts around what you think it might be doing for the future generations and, you know, those coming through maybe in football academies and stuff as well.
Without a doubt. You know, I mentioned it before with even advertisements. You know, I think it's Ray Winston you see straight away, next goal. You know, they obviously are over-advertising for me, because I don't think gambling companies need to advertise, because if you're going to gamble, you know, it's, you know, it's always there. You don't sort of see an advert and go, I'm just going to start gambling here. You know, that's just always going to be in that person. You know, everyone's got a different makeup to themselves. But certainly I think it's going to be a problem for, you know, the generation coming through where they see this and they think it's just the norm. You know, as you say, we didn't see that years ago. With shirt sponsors, you know, we didn't know, you know, the names of these, you know, different bookmakers. You know, you sort of knew William Hill, you knew Ladbrokes. That was pretty much Coral maybe back then. But you know, the amount of different sort of you know, companies out there is just absolutely incredible, and it is. I think it is going to be sort of detrimental to. You know, the generation coming through, because you know they're just going to think that it is the norm, because they've grown up with it. They see it all the time, whereas, you know, we didn't see that. You know, so it is going to be a problem, but I don't think it's going to be resolved. You know, that they're going to just stop doing this, because you know it's something that they obviously with betting companies, they want to promote themselves. They want to sort of go, well, you come and bet with me because we're offering more than what such and such are offering. You know, so they're sort of fighting each other to get customers. So I don't really see where it's ever going to be resolved, because you know gambling is always going to be there from forever. You know, there's no doubt about that.
No, absolutely, Keith. And you're talking about Ray Winston there. I was joking the other day, but you know, I said, when will we start seeing Ray Winston refereeing these games? Now I feel like he's there all the time. But, we were talking to Jamie Smith from Problem Gambling in Northern Ireland as part of a recording for our final episode of season one, which will be released next week, actually. And in an off-air discussion, he was telling us just how much of an issue gambling is over in Northern Ireland. Over here, we have a lot of gripes with the outdated 2005 Gambling Act, but over in Northern Ireland, you're still regulated under the 1985 order. So how much of a concern is that for you and for others over in Northern Ireland?
I didn't actually know that was the case. You know, I think you just switch off from whatever act it is. You know, it's at the end of the day for a punter, you know, it's just gambling for them. You know, it doesn't really matter what act's in place or whatever. But I think it's just rife everywhere. You know, there's obviously a problem in Northern Ireland, but I don't think it's going to be any different to what England has or what Scotland or Wales, any of the UK. You know, there's just, as I said before, everyone has different interests, and there is always that little bit of somebody with an addiction with the gambling where they can just get involved in it, and that's them hooked. And that's pretty much how I started, you know, from day one, totally hooked. And that will just happen to so many people, you know, throughout the UK. So I don't think it's disappointing that when you sort of hear that, you know, the guy's saying that Northern Ireland has a particular problem. I wouldn't have, as I mentioned, I wouldn't have thought that it was any worse than anywhere else, but, you know, he seems to think it is, you know, we're a small little country here. And you know, we're very passionate about things. And you know, as I mentioned before, it's just a case of if it's in your makeup, you're going to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Jamie was saying there was that it's a big problem for him because he's there and he sees it and he sees all the issues. But, you know, me personally as well, you know, I go to GA locally to me and we get up to 50 in a room at a time, you know, so it certainly is a big problem everywhere.
In relation to the regulation, I mean, obviously we over here in England, we get a little bit, more than a little bit angst in terms of that we're going off of rules and regs that were set about 15 years ago before, you know, mobile devices being as sophisticated as they are now. So running off an act that is essentially 35 years old, I dread to think, I haven't even had a look at that sort of regulation in terms of what's within that framework and scope. But I dread to think. What I wanted to ask is going back to the football, is, you know, we were talking about sponsorship and such. Do you think, you know, at the top level of the game, as we all know, the main source of revenue for football clubs is all through television revenue. And a few weeks ago, we were talking to The Big Step, and they're working with Tranmere Rovers Football Club. And they're doing brilliant work there with them and, you know, making sure that the community are aware about gambling harm and such. And they're making sure that they don't have any affiliation with gambling companies. Now, do you think that needs to be done from the very top level with the football clubs that can actually afford to rebuff advances? And we're just talking about a social responsibility, ethics and such.
Yeah, I don't think clubs will have that conscience about them as long as they're receiving money from betting companies. You know, they're going to keep doing that. You know, and you can't understand it, because if you're going to get X amount of money from a betting company, but you're not going to get as much from another non-betting company, you're obviously going to, you know, it is a business where, you know, you need to make money. And especially because of, you know, I know they receive, you know, a lot of TV money, but, you know, the wages that they fork out, they need to have that constant money coming in to be able to afford to pay for transfers, to pay for wages, or else you just fall behind. You know, so if one club was to do it, you know, I couldn't see other clubs following suit, because the one club that does it will then think, well, why should we do it if nobody is following suit? You're going to need everybody in it together where they're going to do that. And for me, that is just not going to happen. because it is too big a business.
I mean, a few years ago, I mean, as everyone else has said who they support, I'm a massive Aston Villa fan, unfortunately, doing absolutely terribly. Tell me about it. And a few years ago, I mean, we've been associated with a lot of betting companies over the past decade. You know, we are approaching a decade where we've had a front of shirt sponsor, which is a gambling company. And I even think before that, it was, you know, a trading application, which could be considered as a form of gambling. But we did, prior to that, we were linked with, for a year or two, we had our front of shirt sponsors as Acorns, which is a hospice that is closely associated to Aston Villa. And from a fan's perspective, the club itself actually got, you know, a lot of praise, both in the media, the fans loved it. You know, we knew that free, I think it was about 3 million at the time, that was going towards, you know, a local hospice that has close connections with our football club. And in the grand scheme of things, particularly as we're, you know, now in 2020, the actual money that they get from, you know, front of shirt sponsorships at the lower end of the league, where unfortunately Villa are, you're talking 3 to 4 million pounds. The gambling companies are systematically targeting the lower ends of the spectrum because they know that they can't afford, you know, the Manchester Uniteds, the Arsenals and such, which are, you know, you're talking 10, 15 times more than what it would to be on the front of, say, a club like Aston Villa. What do you think of that? And do you think that it might be about high time that fans start and put pressure on their football clubs?
Yeah, I think with what you were saying with Aston Villa there, you know, I was unaware, you know, that the money raised went to the hospice, or I think it was the hospice you said. But I think because you're an Aston Villa fan, you sort of know that. You know, I don't think everybody else would sort of know that, if you get what I mean. Other clubs, you know, who have whatever on their shirt, you know, they don't know what other clubs are up to. I think it is an easy target where you can target lower clubs, because I think even with, you know, you're always going to get your Man United, your Liverpools, Man City's, etc., where they're on TV more than others. But with the way football is, especially now at the minute where every single game's on, you know, the exposure they're getting from the front of their shirts is absolutely, you know, incredible now. You know, you can look at probably the only club in the world where you look at sort of Barcelona, and they had, was it UNICEF on their shirt, and no sponsor for years at times, and they're the only club that probably, you know, where they made so much money for the likes of UNICEF, and you think about how many companies out there would want to be on a Barcelona shirt, and they refused all that. Other clubs didn't follow suit because it's too big a business. You know, it is something where betting, as you mentioned, betting companies are always going to target, you know, the below the sort of top six, the big names, you know, because they know no matter what, with Premiership football, they're going to get that exposure out there because of how much football is on TV.
Thanks for that, Keith. It's always great for me to hear about this kind of work with regards to the football sponsorship and stuff. It's like an issue that's really close to my heart because, you know, I've got a season ticket at West Ham. Even though I'm a Liverpool fan, I take my family there, my son. So, you know, it's something which is close to my heart, as I say. But what I want to do now, as we've got you on the show, is talk about your recovery. And, you know, how did you get there? Did you hit your rock bottom? Did you get help from Gamblers Anonymous? You know, what was it? Was it merely a fact of losing money, or was it a lot? Was there a lot more to it?
I think you know, in terms of, a lot of people need that help. I don't know how I did it, where I just knew that I needed to, you know, to stop. I can point out now that I have the occasional bet now, where, you know, be it on a Saturday afternoon, 20 quid on a accumulator, what have you. But for me the problem was horses, and as I mentioned before, boredom. You know, it's something where I just weaned myself off it. My first daughter was born in 2007. I've got three kids now, and you just can't sustain it where you're gambling so much, you know, because you've got more responsibilities in the world. You know, you have a family to provide for. So I just sort of weaned myself off it. The big downfall throughout everything for me has been online betting. You know, because as I mentioned, you know, quite a bit before, losing X amount in your pocket, you walk out of the bookies. That becomes a different story with the online betting. So that was my big problem. So now even I say that I have a bet maybe on a Saturday afternoon, that's not religiously every week. You know, could be sort of once a month, or if I'm going down to watch the matches in the pub with the lads, and you just like to have a little bit of an interest bet. You know, it's not going to break the bank. You know, I'm not going to win fortunes, but it's just a little bit of an interest bet. So that's something I do. I obviously don't have an online account. I need to be going to the bookies to do that. And when I do, I'm into the bookies and I'm out in 2 minutes and there's racing on and I don't bother with it. You know, so I like to have the occasional bet in the golf as well. You know, because with the majors and you've got sort of four days of watching it, you like, I'm very much into my golf, so I like to sort of have an interest in it as well. So as I say, I just wean myself off it, and just sorted the problem out myself.
Thanks, Keith. That's really interesting to hear, because for me, you know, I'm somebody who can't ever bet again. You know, I've made that decision. For me, it would be a slippery slope, I think. But obviously, you've got to a place where you know what the issue is, so you've kind of stopped the online betting, and you could, like say, you have your little interest bets in things. But the other thing that I found interesting was you said, you know, like life changes, you know, you had your daughter and therefore you couldn't gamble anymore. It's very interesting. I'm glad that's the case for you, because I do actually know a lot of people who, through having children, haven't been able to stop gambling. And you know, I just want to get that message out there, really, you know. So what Keith is saying here is for him personally, but for me personally, when I had my kids, it was actually a time when I started gambling more because of the pressure and the stress. So it's just really a message to say we're all different. For me, I know that I can never gamble again. So whereas Keith may be able to not look at the horses and go and do his football bet once a month, that isn't something that I could do. And I respect Keith's decision on that. But also, I just want everyone to know we're all different. And sometimes some people can't gamble. And I just want to make that really clear.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, there's people out there who, if they, you know, maybe haven't bet for 3 years, you know, they're obviously doing very well. But there's, I think with somebody who gambles, there is always that little urge in your head somewhere where they could go back to it. And as you say, they could be on that slippery slope again. You know, I know myself, you know, that if, you know, I'm going and putting 20 quid on and it's not frequent, it's now and again. You know, you're maybe going to win a couple of hundred quid. You know, it's more a thing, I think, with gamblers as well, the thrill of winning. You know, I could have £5 on a horse years ago, or £5,000 on a horse, and it doesn't matter what the figure is, it's that thrill of winning and the adrenaline rush. You know, so it is tough for some people. And I really respect people who have had that problem where they have gambled, and they realise that, right, I need to put an absolute stop to it. I was a little bit more fortunate where, you know, I've been able to sort of control that myself. I know that I don't have that problem anymore. I don't crave, you know, going to the bookies every day. I don't crave ringing up and putting a bet on. I enjoy when I do, and I enjoy when I'm watching the matches and I'm watching the scores coming in. That's the sort of wee adrenaline rush that just is okay for me. You know, I don't ever feel that I'm out of control or I'm going to go back on that slope again.
I really do appreciate you, Keith and Chris, both commenting on your personal experiences. I think it's really great, and I think that's what our pod is all about, sharing the different experiences and talking about how everyone's experience in a way is the same with gambling harm, but in a way the mechanisms and how we get there and how we stop can be very, very different between different people. I just want to go back to some tangents, actually. Keith, we talked a lot about football and how advertising there plays a big part in terms of gambling. What sort of struck my mind is that we haven't really touched on FIFA or like the football, you know, the video game, I mean, specifically. So growing up, I think that was one of my favorite football pastimes. I'm not much of a player, unlike yourself. So FIFA 05 was a big one for me. I think that's the first time you could create your own player, and you can max out their stats. And that was a revelation, and I loved playing that game. And I've played quite a few different FIFAs since then. I think it was about FIFA 13, and that's when I stopped being any good at it. And I still play nowadays. But the thing I wanted to get across is that actually, when we talk about kits, there are kits for young people, for children, but the kits used in on the video games, they have the betting sponsor. So when kids are playing this game, they are going to see the betting sponsor. When they watch the game, they're also going to see that betting sponsor on the shirt. That's a tangent. I think the question I have for you, Keith, though, is another tangent, and it's related to how you started gambling at a young age, and that's something we've seen on this pod dozens of times, and I think it's almost everyone, if I might say. There are some people who started a bit later, but it's still quite a young age, you know, sort of under 25. So what I wanted to comment on and I want to get your thoughts on is, did you feel like you were vulnerable at the age of 20 or 21? You know, you talked about how you were sort of alone in that hotel room. How was that? You know, your brain is still developing until the age of 23, 24 and 25. Do you think that has a part to play in terms of doing something that's unhealthy in terms of gambling, considering how destructive it can be?
Yeah, I think obviously when you look back now, you know, there's things that you wouldn't do. You know, I love playing golf. I wish I'd have taken it up many years ago on a regular basis, because I know then that afternoons I'd have been out on the golf course and not in the bookies. But, you know, that's something which, you know, I just have to live with. You know, I think going to Newcastle as a 19-year-old, that, you know, I'm involved in the biggest transfer in British history at the time with Andy Cole. And bear in mind, I was at Man United, and I've gone from £250 a week to £1,200 a week, and within 10 months, I was on the £5,500 a week. You know, so within from January when I signed to the following October, I'd gone from £250 to £5,500. So, you know, you can do the maths there in terms of the percentage increase. So I'm obviously, you know, betting more and more regularly. But I think it was very difficult at that age where I was comfortable in Manchester because I was with people that I knew, a lot of sort of coming through the class of 92, a lot of players my age as well. All of a sudden, I'm gone to Newcastle. I'm the youngest player in the squad, and I'm playing on a regular basis. But I'm playing with, you know, 19 years of age. I'm still very, very young. I'm playing with experienced players, you know, Peter Beardsley, people like that there, who have been about and seen things, where I can go back to finishing training and thinking, what am I going to do for the rest of the day? Gambling was the only sort of thing I knew, because I'd got into it. And bear in mind, when I first went into the bookies, I was 16 years of age in Manchester, and there was no ID or anything like that there. It was easy just to get a bet on, and I was in there every single sort of afternoon. And even when I made my debut for Man United, I was 17 years of age, and you know, I'd be in the bookies then after, and they'd have known that I was under 18. But there were never, ever any questions asked. You know, I shouldn't obviously have been in there. So I think, you are still very young and very naive, you know, your early 20s even. I go back to, you know, it's in your makeup. Some people can sort of mature a lot quicker than others. You know, I was probably a little bit more naive back then. You know, and it's amazing how years, you just get that experience and a little bit more know-how. And that's just a sort of life thing where you are going to sort of grow up and understand things a lot better. But yeah, I totally agree. I think a lot of sort of players, you know, some of them get married very young, and that can help them where they're in a very steady relationship. I got married when I was 24, but you know, the marriage didn't last that long. You know, and things can just be very, very different for different people. You just don't know sort of everyone's, you know, personal circumstances and what is in everyone's head, because it's all different.
Thanks for that, Keith. I just wanted to, we're coming to an end now, so I just wanted to ask, what's current day Keith Gillespie? What are you up to, and what are the plans for the future?
Yeah, I'm actually involved in the agency side. We want to look after a lot more younger players, and I think, in terms of agents, you know, you don't have very much credibility in being an agent. I've had agents myself. I was very fortunate that the second one that I had, I'm still friendly with to this day, because he knew that the player was the most important thing and looked after me properly. I had an agent previous to that who didn't. You get agents who want to make decisions which are selfish, because it's more for them than what it is for the player. You know, they should be telling the player, I'll probably get such and such out of this deal, but I don't think it's the right move for you. Agents won't do that. And I think because I've been involved in the game, I know what it takes to be a good agent and how players like to be looked after. I've obviously had my problems over the years, and I want to be there for players where they can go, give me a call. And I've been in a dressing room of, you know, you suffer when you don't play, you know, you can have problems off the pitch, and I've been there and done all that, and I want to build the relationship with players that we are going to sign up or look after, where they can come to me and you know, I can give them sort of the voice of experience.
Really, really good to hear, and it's good to hear that you're using all your experience. That's a good effect. And on behalf of us all connected with the All Bets Are Off podcast, I'd just like to wish you all the very best with your future endeavours. It's been an absolute honour and a pleasure chatting with you. And honestly, for any of our listeners that have yet to have a read of Keith's autobiography, you simply have to go out and purchase it. I've read some pretty decent autobiographies in my time, and my goodness, is most definitely up there. It's a sorry story, but one I'm sure all of us that have suffered the grips of gambling addiction can relate to. Please stick around for our hero of the episode, and we'll catch you next week for our season finale.
Cheers, guys.
Our heroes of the episode this week really does keep in line with the football and addiction theme. Earlier this week, England goalkeeping legend Peter Shilton and his wife Stephanie had a feature on BBC primetime television, The One Show, in which they discussed Peter's 45-year battle with gambling addiction. It's stories such as this that will help raise awareness of the issues, and I'm sure on the back of this programme many people will have reached out for the support that they so desperately needed. On behalf of the All Bets Are Off team, thank you.